Potscastlandia. I've got a really big treat today. I am here with Owlish Fun, who is going to talk to us a little bit about 1930s life for Steve and therefore, of course, Bucky, but mostly focusing on Steve and figuring out exactly in the celebration of the month of his birth, what life would have looked like back then. Owl, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a complete pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What a delight. So let's kick this off the way we kick off everything. And why don't you tell me your fandom origin story?
Okay. So in the broad sense of fandom, I've dabbled in so many different things. I started out as a huge Cardcaptor Sakura fan. I had a fan site, which is now defunct because it was on GeoCities. I used to write fan fiction for a little while for a like C-list anime called Shinzo, which aired in New Zealand. I never finished it because I lost like 3 chapters and I just couldn't rewrite them, but that was my attempt at fan fiction. It's not my jam. I was a huge Harry Potter fan for a long time, and then Blade of the Nebula actually got me into the MCU. So I'd seen all the films up to that point. I'd watched them with like my friends, that sort of thing, but I'd never really been in the fandom. But when I met Neb, it was like she kind of introduced me to the fandom. She introduced me to shipping Tony and Steve, and like it was kind of she was my gateway into the fandom, so I owe a lot to her. And then I've never had much to contribute to the fandom, which is why I started my blog.
Well, first of all, contribution is always participation as well. But thank you so much for, and speaking of your blog, let's dive right in. So give me a flavor of kind of some day-to-day life stuff of what Steve Rogers in the 30s would have looked like.
Okay, so there's so much, honestly. I mean, I started out by considering where he might have lived. So that the funny thing about when you look at historical content for a fictional world is that there's no right answer. There's just less wrong answers. So I try.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much. It gives us so much more freedom to create. It's like, yeah, well, he can't have an iPhone, but he can have he can have some other stuff. Yeah.
That's it. So like what I like to do is like look at the options and then you can use your headcanon to work it out. But like one of the first things I considered when I started into this is where would he have lived? And I kind of narrowed it down to 3 areas, which would be Dumbo, Brooklyn Heights, and Red Hook. And which of those 3 it comes down to are completely up to you. I prefer Brooklyn Heights, but historically, accurately, I would probably say Red Hook is more likely just because of the demographic of who lived there, the rent, the likely money that Steve had to work with, that sort of thing. So that's your first place you want to figure out where he was living. You want to look at the time period. So if you're in the 30s, you're looking at the Great Depression. And if you're looking at the early 40s, you're looking at war era. And you think those would be very similar, but when it comes to things like rationing and what you could afford, the things like food were really different. So things that were accessible during the Depression wouldn't be accessible during the war because they were rationed and vice versa. So like that's just living and food, like little things like that. If you're looking at how he lived, he probably lived in a tenement building just because he's the son of 2 Irish immigrants who prior to the turn of the century were like one of the most looked upon groups in American history. So they were, you know, they were prosecuted. They didn't have the right to vote for a long time. So he's poor. He's got a single mother because his father died. We're talking poor. We're talking like dirt poor Steve Rogers. So yeah, there's so much. Send me in a direction.
Let's talk about like for folks who don't know what tenement life was like. Unpack what a tenement is.
So a tenement is, I'm not up on the US lingo, but I think it's similar to what you would think of as a walk up. So you've got no lift. You've got a multi-story apartment with multi-story buildings with multiple apartments. Apartments are typically 1, maybe 2 bedroom. You've got a living space, which is both your living room, your dining room, your kitchen, and your bathroom. You've got a bathtub, which doubles as a table. You've got you've got a heat source, which is also a food, you know, your cooking point. everything is sort of dual purpose because you live in a really confined space. Consumerism hasn't kicked in. So consumerism for like the middle class and the lower really kicked off in the 50s. So everything is, you have it because you need it, not because you want it.
And it's important to remember that you're going to know your neighbors really well because you're all going to be sharing. There is indoor plumbing, you're sharing the indoor plumbing. Plumbing at all. So
that's it exactly. If you, the bathrooms are communal for the entire building, and you're lucky if they're indoors. There's in the older ones, you've got outdoor bathrooms, and they are nasty. They are just, if you've ever seen photos of them, they are just, oh, I couldn't imagine. If there's a telephone in the building, is one, and everybody shares it, but that is a luxury. So
yeah, I would imagine in looking at the demographics of Red Hook, which is my headcanon, that's where I always have them is Red Hook. Looking at the demographics of Red Hook and even Dumbo, because you know Dumbo wasn't really anywhere that people who could afford to choose where they lived until the early 2000s and gentrification. So, but if we look at Red Hook, I can't see there being a telephone outside of like the Irish bar. Cause when you read Irish immigrant stories, I've said this many, many times, my husband's mother, half her siblings came over in the 70s. And even then, the bar, you went in to the pub, and that was the phone that everybody signed up for times to use to call home. And that was like, that was kind of how things worked. So Sarah probably went to the, like somebody else was in charge of getting all the news from home for her. And, you know, four or five stores down and those kind of things like that, she probably would have walked to work. And then we're talking about sanitation issues with a really, really sick kid.
Yes. Yes. I'm almost too afraid to go into the medical history because there's so much to it. It's so deep. It's knowing, you know, the treatments, it's knowing who had access to doctors and that sort of thing. It's, oh, Steve's medical history gives me like tremors every time I think about it in a historical sense. I can't believe that boy lived.
Well, I mean, he lived in a comic book, thank God. But
yes.
So speaking of though, like kind of the, some of the historical stuff, one of the things that sometimes people run across is like how, if we all headcanon Steve as queer, which if we're in fandom, we pretty much do.
Yes.
What would queer life have looked like in those neighborhoods in Brooklyn in the 30s and 40s?
Yeah. So one thing I've done like a rough overview of a lot of queer history in America, in New York, and it's super interesting, but it's also super changeable. So if you start in prohibition times in the 1920s, there was actually a huge boost in visibility because you had all of the bars, the pubs and things like that going underground. So everything was already underground if you want to get a drink. So those places were hiring queer people. They were having queer performances. You'd have, you know, straight people coming and watching those queer performances as a form of entertainment because it was all illegal anyway. You paid off the police to not come raid your bar, which means you also had them not coming and raiding, you know, the people who were in the bar. But once prohibition ended and you had all the laws coming in to then for liquor licenses and that sort of thing, it sort of tightened up again. So you had this period of like relaxation during prohibition, but the moment prohibition ended, all of these places where people could go were now in the public light again. You had laws that prevented bars and things like that from hiring queer people and sometimes from even serving them. So it went a lot more underground in the 1930s. You still had groups that met up. You had a lot of, it was very community-based from what I can see, very sociable. So you still had gatherings, but they were much more underground and they were much more prosecuted. So if he was involved in anything, I would say it would be very, very sort of secret squirrel, I guess you would say, or you would sort of keep it to yourself and try not to be seen that way. But I think for Steve, he would have a lot of trouble. One of the things I came up with, I love language, so I love finding slang terms. If you know my blog, if you're on my Discord, you know I love my big old dictionary of slang terms. It is my pride and joy. So do you want to hear a few historically accurate terms that would have been used in queer culture?
Please.
Okay, so I guess we can start with gay as your essential one. Was it used? Yes. So gay used to describe someone as homosexual, you're looking at around 1933, so that one is a term you can definitely use. Some of these are going to be derogatory. I apologize now, so just be aware. You've got terms like, and these are all going to be historically accurate, you've got homo describing homosexuals, butch describing someone who's overly masculine or someone fulfilling a masculine role in a homosexual relationship. Drag was perfectly fine, so that was a term that was used. In fact, the term drags was used as a word to describe someone who dressed in drag. You've got things like cruising. So cruising was something you would do, which is looking for a casual sexual partner. Let's see, we've got daddy was a term for a dominant partner in a male homosexual relationship. Apologize for now, but faggot, fag, all of those were in use. The term you are most likely to see in New York is fairy. So fairy was probably the localized slang. So you would have different slang in New York than you would have in, say, Chicago.
Yeah, and fairy is still the dominant
yes
term in most of the Eastern Seaboard, like Baltimore up to Boston. That's still a very, which operate a lot as a linguistic block in some ways. That's still the word that that is flung the most.
Yes.
Because people don't think it's as derogatory, which is false.
Yes, but it's definitely, and I see it coming up in FIC quite a bit, which is like, fills my heart with joy because it's an accurate term. Just running through the list, you've got things like femme was used, flaming, fruit. One I came across in a study from the period was, how would it be, mentes, M-E-N-T-E-S, which was used to describe anyone who menstruates. So if you had someone who was genderqueer, you would describe them as that if they menstruated, for example. So there were genderqueer terms in the time and they were all sort of very internal. Punk, yes, punk was used to describe someone who was younger or weaker in a homosexual relationship. It did also mean poor, lousy, and inferior. So it was it did have multiple facets at the time. There's a lot of terms. I'm actually gonna be posting this list soon because I had so much fun finding it, but there were so many terms that were in use. So I think if you want to be writing from that period, take that second to go to like etymology, I get those two mixed up, .org, I think, and just search that term and see that it was in use or if it came later on, because it's a really easy search, but it's one of those things that can just give a little bit of authenticity to whatever you're writing.
That's such a great point too, because we talk about it a lot on the pod of like, if you don't care and then you don't care, then fine. But if you care at all, then there's a lot of resources out there to make it look like you care in a way. And language is one of those things because things move and evolve so much. And ferret is a huge word nerd, as you know, and everyone who listens to this knows. My PhD is actually in the description of using words as ways to build community, not from a linguistic perspective, but from a sociological one.
Yeah.
So we love words around here. And I think one of the other things coming from the American kind of overall sociology perspective is coming out of Prohibition, the use of code words stayed, the use of different secret words for different people stayed. As some of the things, and that's one of the things that really permeated the queer community forever. And there's a great documentary for my American listeners on Hulu right now called Pride that has a whole hour on the 1950s, queer life in the 1950s. And it makes the point, like, it wasn't all miserable. People had parties. We just did it in people's houses. Like, yeah. Like it was illegal and weird and all of those kind of things, but it was also a life of joy. And I would imagine, especially because the 30s was in so many ways about finding small moments of joy and family whenever you could, however you could, because you were going to starve to death the next day, possibly, that Steve's life would have had joy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even just queer communities at the time, they had to be underground, but they were, from everything I see, they were exuberant. They were close-knit communities. They were loud and colorful. even in the 30s, like it was there. You just had to know where to look.
I love that. And that is so much more fun for fix too, of kind of like, I mean, the man, the options are endless. I mean, there's so much pre-war Steve Bucky fic that plays on this beautifully, but there's a lot of Steve fic in general, Steve with any of his partners, whether it involves time travel or anything else that, that really plays with the secrecy of the time and how you can use that for sexy times.
I come at all this from, like, weirdly enough, I'm usually not a fan of First Avenger period fic. I like it, but it's not my favorite. I kind of love thinking about it through the lens of how would Steve interact with the world after defrosting? How would he see the world and, like, you know, overlay it with his knowledge of the world? What terms would he know? What terms would he not know? What things could he surprise people knowing about? Because people just assume that everything was invented in the, you know, in the 60s.
So what is, of the two options where, like, Steve is befuddled by technology or Steve learns technology really fast, what camp do you fall into?
I'm going to say befuddled simply because I know enough people, you know, elderly people who just can't get their head around it. It's easy to pick up technology when you grew up with it because you almost went through the stages of development and you know it. But when you just come at it from, like, zero, you know, zero to 100, I think he would struggle. I think he's smart enough to pick it up, but I think he would struggle.
Yeah, I think my favorite fix are the ones where he, like, everyone assumes he's a total mess with it, but he's learned it faster than he thinks, and he can, like, get one over on Tony. That's one of my favorite fix.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Great, great trope. So in terms of, like, Steve Rogers and the 21st century, as it were, what are some other elements of that you really like exploring?
Oh, gosh. I mean, all of it. I like having to put yourself in the mindset of looking through a different period's lens. I like the challenge of it. I like the questioning everything you know and second guessing it and going, is this a fact or is this something I'm assuming? I think when it comes to what I read, honestly, I love just about anything. I love smart-ass Steve. I like innocent Steve. I love all Steves. I'm a big fan of when you bring Bucky into it and then compare their different reactions to the 21st century. That's always so much fun because they're different people. They're going to react differently.
I love that point. Yeah. And that, I mean, and then we can get into the class thing, that there's a lot of evidence that Bucky and his family were more middle class and Steve obviously was very poor. And so if we really play with that dynamic, my God, maybe Tony's wealth isn't quite as terrible if he can put it in the category of Bucky, or maybe it's even worse because he puts it in the category. Like, you have so many different branches off the tree of the idea you can chase, which is why we all do transformative works.
Oh yeah. 100%. Oh, it's, I love this fandom so much because there's so much to work with, and I love so many of the characters that I can come at it from so many different angles. I mean, I don't think I was a big Harry Potter fan, but I've never been as involved as I am with this fandom because there's just, what I like about it is I like the characters, and there are so many good characters with such fleshed out personalities and backstories. There's so much to play with. It's just, it's a sandpit and I can do whatever I want with it.
Yes. Absolutely. I love the people. Yeah, I've been involved in a lot of fandoms, but this is the one that I've definitely done the most output for. And not just because all of these incredible events that just make me want to keep creating, but because there's so many, I can write the same story six different days and write it six different ways. And it's because of the different dynamics of all of the people, and they've all lived such rich lives / traumatized lives that we can really, really muck around with it. So in terms of, like, your OTP, are you a Stony person?
I approach it as I will take any combination of Tony, Steve, and Bucky, as in any duo, any trio. Those are the characters, and I feel comfortable shipping them with each other, with other people. I've recently, because I've been watching Loki, I was never a Loki fan, but now I'm like, I kind of want to read more Loki. So I've been reading, like, any of those three ship with Loki just to see a different perspective. And it's been like a whole new world of fic. And I'm like, I've never read any of these.
That's how I feel whenever I dip into Frost Iron, because of those three combinations, Loki Tony is my favorite. They make the most sense to me and I have the most fun with them. And oh my gosh, the Loki fandom is so rich. And there's so much out there. I have not started watching Loki yet, but I have definitely, the show Falcon Winter Soldier has reignited my love of Bucky and writing him from in various ships. So
There are whole different tropes in Loki fandom.
Yes.
Like there are things that I see keep coming up that I'm like, this must be like ingrained fanon because it comes up in every single one of them. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like there's this whole new world I'd never known of.
And the more content we get, I just keep thinking, I look at the calendar and be like, okay, in 5 months, we're getting the Eternals. Like how many more characters are we going to get? Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
I have to admit after Endgame, I was almost scared to keep going because I was like, I'm almost like accepting that this is the end of some of my favorite characters. But so I was like really tentative when all the new series came out. But I've been blown away by all three of the miniseries so far. Like it's like my passion for the series has been reborn because I'm like, oh, they can do these characters justice.
Oh, that's exciting. That's exciting. I am not a huge Wanda fan. And so I haven't delved into WandaVision. I do plan on watching Loki. I still don't plan on watching WandaVision, but I love so much on the Steve Tony Bucky Discord that I help mod with Ferret and Moody. It was so much fun every week watching that channel explode as people came with all their theories and everything else. I really, really loved it. I love anything that makes within fandom that brings people joy that doesn't harm other people. And so this content that Marvel is giving us as, you know, problematic as it may be, or frustrating as it may be, or joyful as it may be, or wonderful as it may be, that it's sparking creation and discussion is just beautiful.
Oh, it is. The funny thing about the miniseries is I got more out of the ones I wasn't expecting to like. So Loki and Wanda were characters that like I didn't dislike, but they weren't my big jam. But the way they handled it, like it's kind of more on an aesthetic level that I love them aesthetically.
That makes sense.
As much as I do this period for study, I'm a huge, huge nerd for the aesthetic of mid-century. And both of those have just like they blew me away. So like I didn't think I'd love them, and I adored them.
That's good to know. Mid-century is my best friend, who I refer to as soulmate in fandom. Mid-century is her jam. I'll be interested to see when she gets around to watching Loki, what she thinks of it.
If she's like me, she'll die in happiness. It's so good.
She's good. I'm sure. I can't wait now. I didn't know there was a mid-century thing in that one too. She will love to know that. So I want to be mindful of the fact that like we could go on forever,
could.
I also feel like we're at a pretty good stopping point. So is there anything specifically you want to bring up about pre-war Steve and Bucky that you'd like us all to kind of keep in mind and remember?
I guess just if you want to either write in that period or try and be historically accurate with the way Steve or Bucky perceive the world, just kind of check your assumptions. So it's really easy to assume the world has either always been the way it is, or it changed suddenly and everything past the 50s was just a world of difference. Check that and just, you know, really double think. Check it. Think, oh, would this have been available? And a lot of time it's a quick Google search can give you, when did this product come out? Or how much was this? Or there's great, you know, inflation calculators, that sort of thing. I guess I would just say, you know, stop and think about everything. And it doesn't have to take time or pressure, but it's kind of a fun way to look at the world. And I don't know, it's opened my eyes to a whole new sense of being in this world, trying to put myself in the lens of someone who lived 100 years or so ago.
I love that. And that's one of the beautiful things we can do in fandom. So Owl's going to get me her recommendations, and we're going to make sure to link her blog in the show notes as well. So you'll get, make sure to check the show notes for the Fic Rex and the blog and any other resources we dig up between now and then. Owlish, thank you again so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
All right, friends, this make sure to follow Owl and learn more from this incredible conversation as we go forward.